Next case is 04-106, Ohio State Bar Association versus Steven Stern. Mr. Kravitz.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. I represent with Janet Kravitz the respondent Stephen M. Stern in this case. Seated at counsel table is Mr. Robert Hendrick, counsel for the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association. The Columbus Bar Association found that no ethical violation had occurred in this case twice. A distinguished hearing panel found that no ethical violation occurred under the facts of this case. The findings of fact of this distinguished panel were adopted by the Board of Commissioners on Grievances and Discipline. Respondent Stern's position is that the conclusions of law reached by the board were unreasonable in light of the findings of fact which the board adopted, the hearing panel found, and after the Columbus Bar Association had twice dismissed this complaint. Advisory opinion 97-3 strikes an appropriate accommodation between the needs of the lawyers in the profession and the needs of prosecutors and criminal defense attorneys and attorneys who need to protect themselves.
Mr. Kravitz, let me try to get us to the point here. There seems to be a lot of concern that if Mr. Stern is reprimanded in this case, that that's somehow going to affect the ability of prosecutors in this state to investigate criminal activity. I don't understand that, because this is a question of Mr. Stern talking to an investigator or a person representing the discipline system. It's not about his ability to investigate a crime. Can you clarify that for me? It seems to me like this issue, you made the issue much larger than it is, and the prosecutors obviously here, I guess they think it is too, but this opinion, if we were to follow the board's recommendation, certainly an opinion that's written, in my view, would clearly say that this is a matter of a lawyer who lied. And that's it. It's not a matter of his ability to prosecute, or any prosecutor's ability to surreptitiously infiltrate a drug ring or whatever. That's not the issue here, is it?
As a threshold matter, DR-1-02-102A2 is to prevent lawyers from perpetrating frauds and from harming other third parties in the public. Those interests are non-existent in this case. To get to the question that you posed, if a prosecutor has the right to employ in an appropriate case, and the findings of fact were this is an appropriate case, and the Office of Disciplinary Counsel in this case was being manipulated by the Smiths, they were using the office to interfere and impede in what has been conceded to be Mr. Stern's numerous ongoing civil and criminal investigations of the Smiths, then under those circumstances, the Smiths were engaged in potential criminal activity, obstruction, and other offenses. And if he has the right to use surreptitious taping, when everyone has conceded he has ongoing investigations, then implied in that right is the right, if it is necessary, to say that I have to use means to make the taping effective. In this case, on August 20th of 2000, Mr. Stern, in a very professional and very cordial way, wrote a letter to disciplinary counsel that said, I have legitimate ongoing investigations right now. You are requiring me to turn over evidence of those investigations while they are pending. You're asking me to gather evidence that is in the hands of other agencies. I think he was referring to the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. His very cordial and professional correspondence was ignored. That there was continued interference subsequent to that time. Subsequent to August 20th, the Smiths wrote another letter to disciplinary counsel concerning new allegations regarding Stern's investigation of them. Under those circumstances, he had the right to not only tape, the Smiths would not talk to anyone. They evaded subpoena process. The only people that the Smiths talked to were disciplinary counsel. He had the right to not only use surreptitious means, notwithstanding that it was disciplinary counsel, and to use means, including the denying of the existence of the taping, if he felt that the taping was necessary to be effective. It may not be the call that you would make under the same circumstances, but that's not the issue in the case. The issue in the case is, did he have the right to make the call? And what the hearing panel found was, yes, he proved that he had the right to make the call under these circumstances.
Well, two members of the hearing panel, one dissent, and then, of course, the board. We're looking at the board's recommendation. That's what's before us, and the board, you know, recommends a public reprimand because he lied to the investigator, and he didn't have this right to surreptitiously tape the interview. Why would his interest have not been served had he told the investigator that I'd like to tape this conversation? And then if there are questions that impinge upon his investigation of the Smiths, he tells the investigator that, and I don't want to answer the question. Is that not realistic in this situation?
It's entirely realistic. The question is, did he have to? And Mr. Stern's position and the position of the Ohio Prosecutors Association and apparently the position of the Columbus Bar Association and the position of the hearing panel, which involved two retired appellate court judges, was under the unique circumstances of this case, yes, he could deny the existence of the tape. Each case has to be determined on a case-to-case, on a case-by-case
sure.
basis.
Sure.
There is probably no prosecutor in the state of Ohio who has more of a right to be concerned about what is happening concerning the interference with his investigation by the Office of Disciplinary Counsel than respondent Stephen Stern. The findings of fact held that he was a victim in the past.
Well,
so you're not dealing with someone without a history.
Let's make sure we understand. That was the past, and that was the past. Very, very, that's not a very strong argument, frankly, because that was many years ago, 17, 18 years ago, and everything's changed since then. He may have felt that in his mind, but that's not a realistic fear for him, I don't think.
What the as I understand, to answer your question, the concern of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association is that as a prosecutor, you are responsible for the acts of your agents. Whether it is a prosecutor who is a law enforcement officer and has a statutory exception to all of the wiretapping statutes in Ohio, if a prosecutor, whether it's a prosecutor or an undercover officer, since the prosecutor is responsible for the acts of the agent, if you direct someone to deny the existence of a taping, you could be in the same position that Mr. Stern finds himself in today.
But see, again, this is that That's 4.2. That's this whole issue of can prosecutors, you know, issue. And that's not this. This case is an investigation of him. It's not his ability to investigate criminal activity.
Well, we think that it is his. In fact, the investigations were numerous. No one has contested that the investigations weren't numerous and ongoing and serious. And the other interest in this case is to what extent, if you are the target of a criminal investigation by an elected county prosecutor, to what extent the remedy for a person who believes that they're being unfairly treated is to seek a remedy in the courts. It's not to go to disciplinary counsel. From Mr. Stern's vantage point.
Counselor, yes. As a former prosecuting attorney, I would take issue with that statement. I can't tell you the number of times disgruntled defendants reported me and my assistants to disciplinary counsel. It happened when I was a common pleas court judge, happens as a county prosecutor, and I'm sure at some point it'll probably happen in this position as well. But, you know, that's par for the course.
Agreed. It is par for the course. But the point is, in this case, in most cases, what happens, as I understand it, is disciplinary counsel sends a letter, and it says, you're asking us to interfere in an ongoing investigation, and we are going to withhold any judgment in this matter and withhold any judgment as to the conduct of the prosecutor until the prosecutor's investigation has run its course. And I think there's a standard form letter that says that, and quite frankly, Mr. Stern's August 20th correspondence to disciplinary counsel mirrored what disciplinary counsel says to potential grievance when they want disciplinary counsel to interfere with an ongoing investigation. Instead, in this case, both before that letter was sent and after that letter was sent, disciplinary counsel took it upon itself to question these ongoing investigations, make Mr. Stern justify doing what he was doing. And at some point, Mr. Stern says, I want to know what these people told disciplinary counsel. They won't talk to me.
And quite
he
frankly,
made the call.
Counselor, the procedure here and what happened and whether he thought he was stepping through landmines or whatever, with regards to an investigation that, from my understanding, never came to fruition, never resulted in charges, but that's just another matter. How does that justify the dishonesty?
The dishonesty in the context of this case is, in my opinion, outside the scope of 102A2. The dishonesty, he denied the existence that a tape was taking place. It didn't impede disciplinary investigation. It didn't involve a harm to the public. It didn't involve, as a matter of fact, the tape was never used. It was for preservation of evidence and his own protection. And so the conduct in this case would seem to be outside the scope of that disciplinary reg anyway. Yes, he denied the existence that a tape was taking place. Yes, he made, according to the findings of fact, a reasonable decision to deny the existence of the tape. As I said, it may not be the call that you would have made in similar circumstances. The question is, did he have the right to do it? And what are the ramifications of saying that he did not have the right?
Counsel.
And those raise profound interests for the 88 elected county prosecutors in this state. I'm sorry.
I'm reading from the findings of fact. The panel also concludes, based on the findings of fact, it appears the Smiths were manipulating the Office of Disciplinary Counsel in an effort to curtail respondents' investigative activities. Now, not to impinge the disciplinary counsel, they may not have been known they were being manipulated, but that's an actual finding of fact by the panel. My understanding is that was adopted in full and not refuted at the next level?
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Kravitz. Mr. Mann.
Good morning. May it please the court. The facts of this case are simple but important, and I'd like to take just a few seconds to talk about a couple of the important facts. Professor Smith, a professor down in Steubenville at Franciscan College, filed a grievance with the Office of Disciplinary Counsel regarding Mr. Stern. Under GovBar Rule 5, Section 4, C as in cat, the Disciplinary Counsel had a mandatory duty under the rule to investigate. The rule says they shall investigate. So they did their jobs. That's what the Disciplinary
Counsel. Counsel, is it true that they send letters in other investigations saying they're going to withhold investigation until the criminal matter is concluded?
I don't know what they do in other cases, Your Honor. I know
if they
done
do that,
cases,
which is maintained as a regular, at least Mr. Kravitz maintains as a regular practice, if they do that, how does that conflict with the duty you've just given us?
Well, certainly there's no evidence in the record that they do that, and much I think Mr. Kravitz and I disagree about this case. I'd like to talk about the facts and the records. I have no knowledge of that. It's certainly not in the record, and I have no personal knowledge of it. And that's the best answer I can give, Your Honor. There was a meeting. Mr. Stern secretly bugged the meeting and lied about it. And the reason the Disciplinary Council asked about, are you taping this, is they had knowledge that he typically bugged his meetings. And in fact, he had what was called a high-tech system, a boombox, in his office.
Counsel, if he had said, yes, I plan to tape this, how does Disciplinary Council respond to that?
I would think they'd say fine.
Do we know that?
No, that was never developed in the record.
Might they say you're now impeding an investigation or failing to cooperate?
I suppose they could say anything.
I mean, they did bring that charge here.
We brought that charge.
Yes.
Yes.
And I don't understand that charge.
I believe under GovBar Rule 5, Section 4, G as in George, no justice, judge, or attorney shall neglect or refuse to assist in an investigation, and lying to disciplinary counsel expressly is not assisting, it's failure to assist. And that's why we brought that charge.
All right. Well, let me ask you, you said that the disciplinary counsel did what they ordinarily do, required to investigate, they sent out a letter.
Sure.
And those letters are exhibits in this case, are they not?
I don't believe they're exhibits. No one from disciplinary counsel testified. Mr. Kravitz has attached documents to his brief that are not part of the record, and they may be in that.
I thought they were exhibits.
Perhaps you're right, Your Honor, but I'm not aware of that.
All right. The first letter, August 3rd letter, I have copies, so I assume I have copies of exhibits. I don't.
Mr. Kravitz did attach to his brief documents that are not part of the record in this case. Whether those are exhibits or not,
I'm not talking about things that are in his brief right now, at least I don't think I am. The first letter was vanilla and was responded to. The second letter, August 17th, 2000. It's lengthy, but I'm just going to read you the. This is a further inquiry from disciplinary counsel. The first question is, did you contact an administrator at the Franciscan University of Steubenville, Mrs. Smith's employer, to report Mrs. Smith's contribution to your opponent's, Mr. Feldman's, campaign? A, if yes, when did you contact and why? Now, what on earth does that have to do with an appropriate investigation by disciplinary counsel?
Oh, that was the grievance that Professor Smith filed. There was a murder case down in the Steubenville area, and some students from Franciscan University.
I understand that. We've heard the case, and in fact, the correspondence reflects that he was in the middle of the trial when he's being asked to answer all this stuff.
I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor, but what the allegation of misconduct was this man went to my superior and basically tried to get me fired by saying I'm not a good citizen because I'm not supporting him, the prosecuting attorney. I'm supporting the criminal defense people.
And what rule does that violate?
Conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice, for one. It's not the prosecutor's job to try to get people fired. for disagreeing with him politically. However, the disciplinary council, after doing a thorough investigation, said there's no evidence of a violation.
Okay, well, I mean, I could read on in this letter. It asks a whole bunch of what seemed to be inappropriate questions. I'm surprised that Mr. Kravitz didn't raise this, but having received that letter and then having disciplinary counsel come visit, it doesn't surprise me that Mr. Stern would decide to tape the conversation.
May I respectfully suggest that what would have been the appropriate thing for Mr. Stern to do is what all of us would have done, hire a lawyer and seek a remedy in court. If he feels that they're out to get him, he said they were trying to set him up. That's in his sworn testimony. That's page 81 to 86. He said they're a corrupt office that protects certain people. That's at page 92. He says that that this was a political investigation.
Did all of this go on after his head injury?
The head injury was in June of 2000.
Did this go on?
In October. The meeting that where the secret bugging took place was in October 12th of 2000. Mr. Stern does say, and this is at page 93 to 95, one of his defenses is the head injury. I don't even know if I intended to do this. I don't even remember doing this, but I see it on the tape, so I must have done it.
He was under a lot of strong narcotic medication, wasn't he?
Perhaps.
Well,
and if that's
I was reading a letter in here that mentions all of the medications that he was on. He was defeated, wasn't he?
Yes.
And is he practicing at the present time?
He is not practicing, he says. He's done a temporary inactive status, which is, I understand the rule, if he goes and pays the fee and does his CLE, he could gain active status tomorrow. If I may follow up on Your Honor's question, if Mr. Stern had just said, I had a mental illness here, and that was the end of it, then this would be a different case. But the real rub, or one of the real rubs in this case, is he didn't do that. He said, I don't know if I intended to do this, and this is at page 93 to 95, volume 1. I don't even remember doing it, but it's there, so I must have. But then in the next breath, he says, the Office of Disciplinary Counsel was obstructing justice. That's on page 80. He says, therefore, I targeted them. That's page 91. I targeted them for criminal investigation. And so he says, I'm doing this as a prosecutor. And then he says, I'm doing it because it's a corrupt office, that they were trying to set me up. That's pages 81 to 86.
Referring to the Office of Disciplinary Counsel still, not the Smiths, but the Office of Disciplinary Counsel.
The Office of Disciplinary Counsel, yes, sir. It says the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, page 92, protects certain people. He says on page 87 of volume 1, this investigation was illegitimate and for an ulterior purpose, and it was politically motivated. He's saying disciplinary counsel is corrupt and they lack integrity and they're dishonest. If he felt that, he should have retained counsel and sought relief in an appropriate court.
Counsel, could we be looking at a much bigger picture here of impaired judgment and based on the head injury and whether he offers contradictory testimony, which is often indicia of a head injury, head injured individual. Are you totally discounting that as a potential here?
If he said, I had a head injury.
Well, we know that. It's in the record.
Well, the board found that they saw no evidence of any impairment. The witnesses found no evidence of any impairment.
There's no medical testimony that he was somehow affected by.
We did not object to their putting in a large volume of medical documents. They say what they say, and I believe, and I raised this at the end of closing argument, those documents show that Mr. Stern is mentally ill pursuant to Ohio Revised Code 512201. Which under the rules of this honorable court means that his license to practice should be suspended. If your defense is, I'm mentally ill, I don't know what I'm doing, under our rules, whether we like the rules or not, you're supposed to have your license suspended until you can show that you've overcome the mental illness.
He's essentially voluntarily done that, though.
Well, I would very much respectfully disagree. As I understand our rules, he could tomorrow or even today go to the clerk's office, pay the fee, show that he's got the appropriate CLE and reactivate his license.
Well, does he still live in Florida?
As far as I know.
I guess your private son,
I know he's got several press releases in the Steubenville area, so I don't know if he comes back to that area or not. And it hasn't been part of our job to investigate his private life, just the facts of this case. But I think that's the real rub, is the point that was made, is it's bad to lie to the Office of Disciplinary Counsel and to secretly bug. That's bad. But the, what's really bad here is the disrespect and the disdain that Mr. Stern has, not just for that office, but for the system. He showed no remorse, no contrition, no regrets. He's indicated he's proud of his conduct, and that presumably he'd do the same thing again today if given the opportunity. We would ask this honorable court to render a decision in this case that protects the Office of Disciplinary Counsel and the disciplinary system. If this court thinks that the office isn't being managed properly, this court will take care of that, I'm certain.
Counsel, what are specifically you asking for? Because you objected as well.
Yes, 2-year suspension. Not simply because of the bad conduct, but because of the often oxymoronic defenses that have been thrown in here.
So,
I think there's 30 or 40
so
defenses.
So we pile on because of the defense that's offered?
I would never pile on. Normally, I sit on this side of the case.
Yeah.
I'm normally on the defense side. But people need to live up to their responsibilities. And in our disciplinary system, when we make a mistake, and we all make mistakes, all of us make mistakes.
So basically, for one lie, which was no, the word no, 2 years out.
One lie, one secret taping, not one scintilla of contrition, not one scintilla of regret, not one scintilla of remorse, not one scintilla that he understands what he did was wrong, and assures us that this isn't going to happen again. We have every reason to believe he'd do it again today.
If he hadn't been asked the question, if he had just taped, the question hadn't been asked, no violation?
Well, it's still a violation of the 97.3 and the disciplinary rule.
That's advisory.
Okay, and it's based on disciplinary rule 1102A4 that says a lawyer should not engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. And it's a misrepresentation to secretly tape in these circumstances. The danger of the secret taping in these circumstances is the party who knows the taping is being done can manipulate and get the other party to perhaps engage in banter or this type of thing that can be very embarrassing. The disciplinary counsel, Mr. Stern, in his testimony equated him with drug dealers. It's perfectly proper to secretly tape people you have a reasonable suspicion are criminals and are going to do some criminal act and then lie about it. This is not who the Office of Disciplinary Counsel is, and I say that as a person who butts heads with them on a regular basis. We butt heads, we disagree, sometimes very substantially, but I've always found the office to be professional. And I think that we need to protect not just that office, but this system, and to send the appropriate message, not the wrong message, because if we send the wrong message, the next thing we'll know is we'll have judges bugging lawyers, and lawyers bugging judges, and everybody bugging everybody. And I think that's not where we want to go. We don't want to have an Ohio where everyone has a boombox in their office that's really a secret recording device.
You do know those cameras are live.
Yes, sir.
Okay, good.
And they're open and obvious, and I appreciate that. And I also realize there's a microphone right in front of me. I appreciate that, Chief Justice. If the court has no further questions, I'll simply thank you very much for your time and your consideration. And I won't take any more of your time.
Thank you
all very, very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mann. Mr. Kravitz, you saved a little over a minute of your time.
Number one, all documents that were attached to the brief appear in the record. Some appear attached to a motion for summary judgment or some other pleading, but everything in the brief is in the record. Number two, I believe that Mr. Stern testified at the hearing as to the letters that he would ordinarily receive from disciplinary counsel, how he would respond in the letters. He would get a copy of the letters that disciplinary counsel would send to a prospective grievant. I don't have a transcript. I sent an associate to the court to look at the public record so that we could determine what happened, but But in any event, number three, there are some procedural infirmities of this case set forth in propositions of law 8 through 12, one being that there was no notice of appeal that was filed by disciplinary counsel, so there's really no jurisdiction, in our opinion, from the, there was no notice of appeal that was timely filed by the April 9th decision of the Columbus Bar Association to dismissing disciplinary counsel's complaint. And finally, when Mr. Stern has been exonerated twice by the Columbus Bar Association and once by a distinguished hearing panel, that speaks volumes to the fact that the issues in this case are far from clear, if not vague, and whatever decision this court makes in terms of adopting Advisory Opinion 97-3 or any other decision, it should operate prospectively only, and no penalty should be. This is one of those rare cases where the aggregate of the circumstances cries out for no penalty whatsoever. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kravitz. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.